You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Marty Stallone. Marty, it's good to have you here this morning.
It's good to be here.
So Marty, the way the show begins is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know about the ways you aspire to live, what you've done, who you, the labels you wear? What do we need to know to start this conversation?
Well, first of all, I appreciate the question. I'm a humble person and a private person by nature, so I usually
don't get this kind of a question.
That's exactly right. But I would start by saying I'm a complicated person, I think. I was asking my wife, Amy, about this question, and we really went in a couple of different directions, but we settled on, and she insisted that I describe myself as a serious person. And so,
yes.
I would describe myself as earnest and dutiful.
Right, right, and that to many people would just simply look serious.
That's right, yeah. Exactly. And yeah. So people really do need to spend a fair amount of time before they actually get to know me well.
Right, right.
I don't know that it's easy for me in even a show, but a story that my mother tells about me is that at one point in my young childhood, mm-hmm. I declared when I was referenced as having been a baby that I never wanted to be a baby. So that was something that my family laughs about.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
As serious as I am, I think I'm irreverent and comedic at times.
Right.
And
right.
Usually people who know me well say that I talk about 80s comedy, usually B-quality movies, mm-hmm, very mm-hmm. well. And usually I can come up with an analogous situation in the most serious of circumstances that I can reference a stupid movie, you might
right,
say.
Right, and I'm guessing that was when you were about 8 to 12 years old.
That's exactly right. Very, very early yes. impressions from some really stupid movies looking back. But I still enjoy that, and what ends up happening is that when I relax, I come home late at night, and I do have a TV in my room, so I fall asleep, and I usually see one of these movies on, and I can't help but watch it. So they're refreshed in my memory. And so, anyway, something will come up today that'll reference an 80s comedy.
Yes, 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 yes.
I think the other thing is that I, again, this is, I asked this question of other people, because I think if I answered it for myself, I might get it wrong. People would say that I'm very industrious and I think big, so I'm usually involved in one endeavor or another. Mm-hmm. And then I'm from the Mid-Hudson Valley, so mm-hmm. I was influenced by the greater New York culture, you might say, although we lived in a rural area in mm-hmm. Cornwall, in okay. Orange County, but my family was from Brooklyn originally, so that was part of, I think, who I am. And my entire family was in the New York area, so we spent trips in my young childhood going into the city, but then coming out. I have one brother, David, who, you know, we were very close friends, and he was really my chief friend growing up. And then in terms of describing who I am, I would say I'm a collection of the roles and experiences that I hold. So I guess I'm most well-known recently for being asked to be the CEO of the hospital, and so that's a recent role, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. I do identify myself as a son, a brother, a husband,
sure.
a father of six boys. People find that surprising.
Wow, that's a big, big tribe.
So, yeah, they're really are. I live in different worlds.
Right,
so.
And we all do.
Right.
We just often don't get a chance to talk about it.
And the worlds don't always interconnect with each other.
The worlds don't, but that is an illusion of boundaries.
Yes.
Whereas when we pass from one boundary to the other, if we are relatively constant as human beings,
yes,
then that exposes the illusion.
I agree, and I enjoy when worlds interact with each other. So, I am a military officer as well.
Sure.
And there was a new commander. There was a change of command ceremony in which I took command of a unit, the medical group up at Hancock Field in Syracuse. And I invited some
and
of
so
my...
And so you're still in service in the reserves or...
The
or
National I, Guard.
Yeah.
The New York
yeah.
National Guard.
Yeah.
And I can tell you how that came to be later on in the sure. show if you wish. But I brought some hospital and family colleagues up there, and it was surreal to have my military family meet my hospital and real family.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just...
Mm-hmm.
Awakening.
Yep, yep. And one of the, in this time in late modernity, we have become so segmented that this failure to bring things together, you see it as an exciting, but it's also a really weird time.
Mm-hmm.
For us to kind of push through the divisions, we need to kind of think about how we
yes.
pull these pieces together.
Absolutely.
So anyway, it's good to get to know you. You brought some music with you. What would you like to start with?
Well, the first song I'd like to play is Billy Joel's Goodnight Saigon.
Okie doke, here we go.
Goodnight Saigon. as sharp as knives, and we were so gung-ho to lay down our lives. We came in spastic like tameless horses. We left in plastic as numbered corpses, and we learned fast to travel light. Our arms were heavy, but our bellies were tight. We had no home front, we had no soft soap. They sent us playboy, they gave us bottle. We dug in deep and shot on sight, and prayed to Jesus Christ with all of our might. We had no cameras to shoot the land.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this morning's episode is Marty Stallone. So Marty, you have a life which spans lots of different things. What have you had to learn? What in order to pull this together for yourself, what did you have to learn in order to know how to live earnestly, seriously, humbly, the life that you've come to value now?
Yeah. I think it's most important to meet people where they're at. And so I think I learned over the course of my young adulthood that people had really strong convictions and for a reason, and that I needed to listen more than talk when going into a situation. Mm-hmm. And I actually am used to being the one asking the questions.
Sure. Yeah.
So I usually have kind of entered in softly into different social circles, and that served me very well.
So, but when did you get the memo that you need to be quiet and ask the questions? And actually, there's nothing humble about asking. The most powerful position in the world is the one who asks the questions that people feel like they need to answer.
I agree.
And
I
that's
agree.
So. Yeah.
I think it was going to Cornell. I went to a Catholic high school, and so there was a lack of awareness, you might say, of different faiths. And I met my current wife, and we had the most interesting discussions, her being a non-denominational Christian, and I coming from a Roman Catholic background. Years
and
later,
you met at Cornell.
And we met at Cornell. Yes. So it just it made me pause and kind of think that I'm in uncharted waters with respect to backgrounds and faiths, and the assumptions that I had weren't necessarily held by all others.
Right.
And similarly, I was an ROTC cadet as a way to pay for college, and that circle was a lot different than my pre-med biology. So I was the only pre-med biology major in that circle. And so it was just seeing that different circles of individuals had held different beliefs, and that it was not my place to go in, and it just didn't work well. I guess there were some early corrective situations where you went in and tried to bring a different belief system or way of doing something into a culture.
Right,
and if that doesn't work out well, you learn quickly if you're being observant. So I try to think of myself as introspective. So ask like what's working and what isn't. And I'm willing to change, I guess.
Right. And and you've had, so how were you raised to have the confidence mm-hmm. that you could step in? Because still to make those observations and to make them as suggestions for change or greater or mm-hmm. greater truthfulness implies a certain kind of bigness to your person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how did that get cultivated in you?
I don't know. My background was, my brother and I were raised in a very paternalistic household. My parents had traditional mother-father roles mm-hmm, from mm-hmm, the sure. 60s and 70s. And we were not in the position to, let's just put it this way, I was okay taking orders. I was okay kind of accepting my role. So maybe that goes to the humility that I referenced before.
And acceptance is a big part of mm-hmm. humility. Yeah.
Right. So I don't know. Some of these things are hard. You just are the way you are. I don't remember evolving into being that way.
Right. But when you, what about the nature of reality did Amy's background make you question?
Well, she was a wonderful, good person. And so it wasn't that it was a question of right and wrong. It was a question of just being different. And so I recognized that immediately. And there was, there had to be, logically, I guess I'm a logical being mm-hmm, as well.
Sure,
there had
sure.
to be some accommodation for different viewpoints, and that there was a central truth that maybe we were looking at from different perspectives, and there was, you know, one truth and different perspectives of that truth.
Right. And what you allow for different perspectives is each perspective is protected or furthered or put forward by a set of institutions or organizations about language, mm-hmm. how you use language, what things mean, but there's some kind of a truth that
yes.
is behind it. But what you're also saying is that personhood trumps ideals.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that.
And in a world where we almost can't see individual persons because we are going to issues or to larger abstract analysis,
it's yes.
oftentimes we don't even see the person in front of our face.
True. I agree with that.
So and
also the concept of complexity,
mm-hmm,
where
sure.
it's not a non-linearity, where it's not one answer for one scenario, is that you have to accommodate there being overlaying principles in the situation that lead the situation not to be so easily understood.
Right. So even within in a highly disciplined framework, the complexity can blow any simplicity out of the water.
Exactly.
And as persons do anyway.
Right. That's right. And that's why actually at the beginning of the show you asked me, and one of the first words I used was complex, because it's hard to give an answer that wouldn't, in a simple way, be contradicted later. And it's like, well, there's this other piece of information that you have to know.
Sure. And it also allows to have a disciplined approach to complexity, ambiguity,
mm-hmm.
paradox, hypocrisy, mm-hmm. all of these things which are words which live really close to each other.
Yes.
Forces us to that place of humility.
Yes. I guess it's okay with me not knowing the answer.
Right.
I'm okay not having to have all the answers.
Well, but you're also okay with living decisively, realizing that you may have to turn on a dime.
True.
And that's the other skill that people often don't get challenged about or get questioned about. What I'm wondering about is you talked about a sense of humor,
mm-hmm.
and so you know I've been in emergency rooms, I've been in the operating room with the staff where things were not going well. I've been in spaces where the sharpest humor and the most brutal commentary is absolutely what you need.
Sometimes called dark humor as well.
Yes, gallows humor,
yes.
dark humor, all of that stuff. Yeah. But so I want to talk. My guess is that because of your ability to accept the orders, but mm-hmm. also realize that you can also when you know how to accept orders, you also know how to manage them.
Yeah. True.
Right?
Yes.
So, and you make, and you become a collaborator in reality with a person who could have command control.
Yes.
And that is what it means to be a person within an institution or an organization where you don't give up all of that judgment. And the humor allows you to laugh about it.
Yes.
You know?
Well, some things are just absurd when you step outside yourself and look at what it must look like from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what comes to mind thinking about medical situations is an old book by Daniel Shem called, I'm going to blank on the name. It was the story about the residents in Boston, basically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, effectively the intern going through the story ends up declaring that the less he does for patients, the better they end up getting. And so, you know, how absurd is that, that everything we're doing is based on kind of that premise that we're doing more harm than good. And it's so absurd that it ends up being funny.
Right, right, right. And it ends up being a call to do no harm.
Mm-hmm.
And a reinterpretation.
Less is more.
Right. But it also is what anybody who has practiced a spiritual discipline who actually was more patient than Reinhold Niebuhr, you know, in the prayer, you know, God grant me, I'm going to forget the actual wording of it.
Right.
The
wisdom to know the difference between the two.
Right. The courage yes. to change the things that need to be changed, and the grace to accept those that can't, and the wisdom to know the
yes.
difference. And Reinhold Niebuhr was the kind of guy that he was a professor of my professors when I was in seminary, mm-hmm. and he would run up and down the stairs of the seminary. He
right.
never walked anywhere. He was constantly. He also had a stroke in his 50s.
Right.
But he what he needed was and the time for the difference to become apparent.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not what we decide as much as what we see.
Yes, absolutely.
Of what we observe and what we value.
That's true. Well, and the tincture of time is sometimes the best decision to kind of mm-hmm. see how things go and to be patient and things
sure.
like that. House of God was the name of that book that escaped me a second ago by Daniel Shem.
Okay.
So that was a sort of dark humor, certainly mm-hmm. about doctors in the gallows.
Sure. I got a whole stream of questions that I'd love to
sure.
ask, but let's cut to music. And what would you like to play next?
AC/DC, Shoot to Thrill.
Now, is there a what's the connection to you to this song?
I think that this is an example of in the moment, an example of intensity mm-hmm. invoking music, whereas
right.
The Billy Joel piece was more retrospective, introspection, camaraderie between people, looking back at something that was painful
sure.
and coming to terms with it. And AC/DC is, to me, emblematic of a band that gets your heart going and when you're
marching
in the
right
moment.
Into the fray. Yeah, got it.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Marty Stallone. So, Marty, you have roles in the reserve, in National Guard, rather. Mm-hmm. You have roles as the CEO at the hospital. You are practicing as a physician at the hospital. Mm-hmm. You are a father of six, a husband. Mm-hmm. You have all of these roles. How does the coming together of them feed you? But also, how does it challenge you or push you in ways that sometimes may feel irreconcilable or take you to the edge?
Well, they all have wonderful relationships underneath them, and mm-hmm. I value the people in each one of those circumstances. Sure. So obviously my family is tremendously important to me. They're really the foundation of who I am, and when I come home, I'm the most authentic there, you mm-hmm. might say.
And how old are your kids?
Well, my youngest is Andrew, and he's going to be turning 8. Mm-hmm. Later this month, in May.
Sure.
And then my oldest is Martin, who is going on 16 in July. So 8 through 16.
Right, right.
And we haven't adopted, if you do the math, we have 2 years apart, and then we adopted a son named Jonathan. And uh-huh. He's my other 11-year-old.
Right. So basically, you started a family right after med school.
In medical school. Yeah. I was an MD, MBA student, and we found out we were expecting Martin in my fifth year. And uh-huh. which was
it sounds really, like it was not a planned event.
Sure. Well, you take what comes in.
No, you work with what you have. Yeah.
And I tell you, it's been a blessing, and that wouldn't have been kind of our my notion of how to do things. But in retrospect, it was the most wonderful blessing. And he's a lot like me, but extremely different than me, and that's wonderful to see. So he also would have been the kind of kid who said he didn't want to be a baby. And in fact, right. we had conversations with him when he was probably in his 7 to 8 year old time frame, when he wanted to have his own apartment down in Ithaca. And we were had to seriously explain to him, you can't do that.
Right, 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 right. It's a powerful thing. But I'm also reminded of a friend of mine used to say, you were born at 50 and mm-hmm. you've had to get younger.
True. That's interesting.
And that's, yeah. So I have a sense for what you're talking about.
Yes.
So, with life is what happens while you were making other plans, is
exactly.
what I was thinking. And you've been able to kind of roll with that.
Yes.
Rather than try to fit it, put it back in the bottle or make it work. So how do these other roles come into play? Because they all happen at the same time.
They were all meaningful to me as I went into them. And so I've really been reluctant to give them up. Mm-hmm. And so I'll just use my military service and
sure.
clinical service. When becoming the CEO, and somewhere, I guess I'm 20 plus years in the military, I had plenty of opportunities to disengage or separate.
Sure.
And now I have the opportunity not to practice, but I love doing both things.
Right.
So it's really the love I've gained for these different roles that I've tried to maintain a foot in those worlds, because they're so important to me.
Mm-hmm. And what is it that can you talk about what each one gives you?
A sense of having contributed, a sense of service. It's in the case of medicine.
So specifically it's with your hands, with medicine.
Yes, yes. But it's also just contributing to, it's what the hospital's about. So let's just, what is the hospital for, is to treat patients. So the chief executive would be...
If you're not treating patients, you're not really part of your team.
Yeah. And especially, and there are non-physician CEOs who are in that position
sure.
who didn't have the opportunity. But if I gave up the ability to treat patients, what would I be?
Right, 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 right. And you can also talk with the others in
yes.
a way that you wouldn't be able.
I think it increases my effectiveness, but I'll leave that for others to...
Right, 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 right. So what about the military service?
At simple terms, we live in a construct that military contributions over time have created the world in which we live here as Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And so I recognize that, and I believe in that. And, I respect my family members who came before me and served in the military, and the millions of Americans who have served, and creating a condition of freedom. Not to say there aren't shortcomings in our military history, to say the least, and that's euphemistic, but
right. And it's not just military; it's international policy that
yes.
goes even beyond the military.
Yes,
sets up.
Yes,
yeah.
I recognize that we operate within a construct that was created by others at other, and it's not automatic. And in other places in the world, it doesn't exist.
Right, and it's far from perfect.
It's granted,
and we
absolutely.
Yeah.
And those two facts can be held at the same time.
Yes. So How is it that you can continue to be fed from all of these different wells, mm-hmm. including a marriage? From what you everything you've described, and not be overwhelmed.
I do get overwhelmed, and that's why we, you know, you have to, you know, sometimes step back and recharge. But there's a lot going on. But they're
so,
all yeah.
so. When do you? So what is the overwhelming like? So we know who you are.
Usually, it's when I can't get to everything I need to get to. It's not that I get exhausted. It's when there's mm-hmm. usually two things happening simultaneously that I need to manage. That's the most stressful scenario to
me. And the gears inside your mind and your heart begin to grind.
Wish I had the clone. That's
yeah,
the
yeah. So what do you do?
Usually I communicate. Even just this past week, I had to explain to the hospital that I had a conflict with a military responsibility, and I work through it. I usually am communicative about my situation. I don't hide it.
Right.
And so I usually work around it. And then I wake up early and I stay up late, not unlike many other people in our society.
Right. So I would say what you have just described is possibly one of the major reasons why we don't find work-life balance in this mm-hmm. culture. And it partly is based on institutions not wanting to hear about the whole life of the person. Mm-hmm. But the other side of it is people who are unwilling to bring their whole lives to the various organizations and right. institutions they're involved in. And those two things conspire to make us paralyzed and angry and frustrated.
That's right.
And burned out. So how is it, I mean, as you have the privilege of being the CEO, so when mm-hmm. you're in a bind, mm-hmm. people kind of have to listen.
Right.
How is it that you can make that available to others?
By not denying it. It's usually we work through people's situation if they come and explain it. And I would challenge a little bit that sure. people can't have the exact same thing that I have because I had it before.
Oh, I'm not saying they yeah. can't, but they don't because right. of two assumptions. Sometimes institutions are not friendly.
Right.
You're saying I'm friendly.
Yeah.
And sometimes people say, I could never share that.
Right.
And so they knock themselves out before life has a chance.
And I think that's probably most, if I were to talk about other people, if I were to speculate,
sure.
They probably don't ask questions that they would be entitled to get answers or help with.
Right. Right.
So.
Right. And sometimes in this culture of obsession with boundaries and then mm-hmm. complete not having them,
yes.
The two extremes,
yeah.
we don't know how to expose our vulnerability.
Yes. Yep.
Or to share it, which I means agree. I got a problem here, guys.
Yep. Help me work through this.
Right.
And I asked for help. Actually, my colleague is covering for me at a meeting that I was supposed to be at, and he was happy to do it. And I was worried about asking it, but I did.
Right.
And now I got to do everything I needed to do.
So these kinds of adjustments also require time for conversation. I grew up in rural Northwest Missouri, mm-hmm. so we did a lot of visiting. And visiting is a major part of work, though most people don't think about it that way. How is it that you build that kind of time into the workday or the workplace so people can really share that information? Because it takes time.
Yes. I mean, I think you just have to... calendar management is always a challenge, and just giving people time. And actually, having meetings over social situations, so lunch meetings and catch up is important.
Right. So you're playing an institutional role
mm-hmm.
in that setting,
yes.
but you're also playing a deeply personal role.
Yes.
And we oftentimes don't want to see those two things.
I've just been different
together.
Than that. I acknowledge what you're saying.
Yeah. No, but I'm saying, but you've been different than that.
Yes.
But you're also saying, what I also hear you saying is that others, you
yes.
out there
yes.
can be different. It's
absolutely.
Just by picking and choosing where to do it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the opportunities for an organization is to allow all of its members to bring in their different situations and their worldview and their experiences. And if we are tolerant of those lessons, I think the organization can be richer for it.
Right. And one of the things that will possibly surprise my audience is that I have seen more disciplined, systematic reflection on this issue from members of the military than I have seen from members in corporate America.
That is true. Well, the National Guard in particular is based on the premise of people in the workforce bringing those skills back into DOD. And that's a great thing. And, and we also form relationships. It's about civil-military relationships.
Right.
And so, you know, if people know Marty at the hospital and he's a good guy, well, then the military can't be so bad. And
right.
I bring all those lessons that I've learned at the hospital to Hancock, and they accept that.
But I've also seen it in regular military folks. And for those, for example, who realized that we're a finishing school for the poor of this country.
True.
That and the chaplains in particular, because there are things that happen to them that could get them permanently scarred or marked, but if they can work it through with these other services, they can oftentimes figure out how to land on their feet.
Yes.
And it's very, and we don't often think of our military playing that role. And there are other roles which are not at all good, but that is one which which helps to, and would that we could be a society that didn't need it, but
Absolutely.
We do, and we'll always need some form of military.
True.
So what you have been out practicing now for
almost
14, 15 years?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So you, how has your practice, how has your life been different than what you thought it would be?
Less direct control. I think I thought that I would have more medical autonomy than exists right now in the medical industry. And I think that's true as you get higher in the leadership echelons of any organization. It's less command and more persuasion and influence and guidance and less actual obedience to an order. And so, and my children are
the notion of best practice, because your complexity argument blows that out of the water.
That's right. And even, and my family actually teaches me the exact same thing. So raising children isn't about telling them what to do. It's a constant negotiation and a steering, a gentle steering, not a path setting.
And a willingness to fight in the best sense.
Yes.
Of engage in open conflict about what matters, but in ways that don't do permanent damage or try
Absolutely.
Not to.
Well, and asking for help, saying this is what I'm trying to, I'm intending to accomplish here, and help me get there. And if I'm not even thinking about it the right way, correct how I'm thinking about it.
Right. But also sometimes I'm going to have to stand like a brick wall and we're going to deal with this.
Yes.
And we're going to discover something about each other that we never knew before.
Yes, that is true.
You know,
yeah, we do have conversations in each of those settings, including with my children, where there is a stance, and then we have to work through it. But there is an expectation. Most recently, and my son might be listening to this at some point, was a phone access after hours, where I was arguing, "Hey, that's probably not a good idea," and he was. Skillfully arguing for phone access after hours
under certain conditions and certain we roll with it.
Yes.
Yeah. And what you describe about negotiating care within a professionalized setting, most of us don't realize that in terms of economic value, the unpaid labor that we care for ourselves, how we brush our teeth, how we eat, how we exercise, how we sleep, how we make choices about foods, all of these things have a more of an impact on our health than paid professional healthcare.
Absolutely.
But we've never had a healthcare reform effort since the early, we had one in the early 1970s that tried to raise that issue, but we have never had one in this country that took it seriously.
Well, the good news is that there's an emerging awareness of the social determinants of health,
right,
which is
what
you're talking
about. That's exactly right. That's the scientific way of putting it.
Yes.
Yes.
And well, what we're doing locally, and I'm very happy to talk about this, is we are seeking relationships with organizations in the community who attend to those needs, whether they be food, security, transportation, education, economic well-being, other social safety nets integrated with medical care so that people can have better outcomes. Because you're exactly right. 20% of outcomes have to do with medical care, typically.
Right.
CDC.
And that's a statistic I didn't know. It's going
the CDC has long espoused that, but that's my business.
Right. No, but it's also partly with my and holistic community development.
Absolutely.
So and here's where it gets tricky. And this is where the person institution difference is important. Organizations relate to people in roles. mm-hmm. and they can strive to do better. But when push comes to shove, their people and roles and organizations and institutions are incredibly expensive to set up and to maintain and to restaff. But people live their lives kind of as they will. Mm-hmm. And it's that voluntary, non-coerced. In an organization or institution, you can coerce people. I mean, it doesn't always pay off well in the long run, but that's always the threat. But in a person living in community, it's always a matter of what they willingly do.
Absolutely.
And how they step up for a fight or how they step back. So in this unpaid healthcare piece, this the way we choose to live just by who we are, there's a need to engage the whole of people
yes.
without this intervening system of organizations because, yes. but we don't know how to do it.
Yeah. My answer to that is educate. I don't have the answer,
sure, no.
but my approach yeah. to it is through education and communication about what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
And it's individuals having a stake. Doctors get upset when you talk about outcomes, you know, metrics and
right.
you're responsible for the patient's outcome because the patient has more to do with their outcome
That's
often than you
yeah.
do.
Right.
So I think telling the patient that, admitting that you only have a minor role in how their outcome really unfolds is
right.
actually, it's liberating for a physician, I think.
It's yes, but
and it's empowering for the patient.
It can be if you go through the frustration piece.
Yes.
Now, as a chaplain, I was trained, when you walk into a room, your head is never higher than the patient's.
Mm-hmm.
They will always be at your level. You will always be at their level or they will look down at you.
Yes.
And that is so that you can have a relationship where the power dynamic gets shifted.
Yes.
And physicians are learning some of the same kinds
thing.
Of lessons.
When you go into a room, sit
right.
down.
Absolutely. Right. And what it often requires, though, is that people who perceive themselves as powerless can't just suddenly perceive themselves as powerful.
Mm-hmm.
That transition takes time. And we haven't figured out as a culture how to invite that reordering because it's not a defensive right. Well, I have the right to do this. It's mm-hmm. more like, how do I get to know what I need to do mm-hmm. so I can do it?
Yes. Well, it goes to health literacy. It goes to education levels. It goes to vulnerability in the situation,
the disease itself. But it goes, yes. And those are all of those knowings,
yes.
which are technically really important. But it also goes to just being a person who is curious, available, and nuts, and not stomping on anybody or being stomped on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's being at peace with each other enough to do that. We don't live in political times where that's the dominant emotion we have towards each other.
Yeah, no, that's true.
And so, but it would seem, if any place, healthcare might be a place where we could turn that corner. If we can let go of some of the institutional focus and look more at the person.
Yeah. I think it's appealing to patients in the moment to take responsibility for their outcomes and then help them accomplish that and ask them to work with you. I couch my recommendations
sure.
as recommendations.
Sure.
I mean, that's
right.
and they have to make the decision right. to listen and comply.
Right. What happens in the setting, though, with the way we've set it up, is that patient is an individual.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard for all of the other persons, because when you see that patient, you're looking at 30 to 70 personal relationships, and Dan Brown was on the show saying 150
right.
total relationships.
Absolutely.
And that's what needs to be related to, but we haven't figured out how to create that moment as a moment of relating to all of those people
yeah.
and not just the individual.
That's true. And I'll just add in
sure.
another interesting
sure.
idea.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The term patient has come under, it actually creates a power dynamic
right.
between the recommender of mm-hmm. a care plan and the person who has to then comply with that with
right.
the complexity of their situation. So,
Right. And in a sense, we're both seekers. We're all seekers mm-hmm. in this process, looking for different things. Some of us are looking for remunerative work that's interesting and serving of others, and others mm-hmm. of us just learning how to live better.
Yes.
But we haven't framed that way in an equal sort of way.
And there's the enemy of time. There's
right.
the enemy that you only have at most. We have a luxurious situation at some times in the hospital where you have 40 or up to an hour with a patient to really work on an acute issue.
Mm-hmm.
But in most outpatient situations, it's 20 to 30 minutes, and that's luxurious.
And that
sometimes.
Has to be scheduled ahead of time.
Yeah,
it's
not in the moment.
10 minutes.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so it's a real challenge. If you look to the medical system to solely improve health outcomes, you're going to be disappointed.
Or if you look to those who are attacking the medical system.
Yeah.
Because that kind of a combative relationship does not lead well to collaboration.
Yep.
Or well, to equality.
And that's why I look to partnering organizations who have specialized niches of interests and abilities to be on the same team as the traditional medical system.
Sure. I hope this was a, this is a slightly different rabbit hole than I thought we might run down.
Happy to go down
it. Thank you. What should we play next?
Well, I think next is Peter Gabriel and Heroes.
Do you want to say anything about it or just let it speak for itself?
I'll comment afterwards. Sure. Okay. If you want, we play it, and then I can say why it was important to me.
I wish I could swim like dolphins. Like dolphins can swim, though nothing will keep us together. We can beat them forever and ever. We can be heroes just for one day. How we can be heroes just for one day.
Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Marty Stallone. So, Marty, tell me about that song.
Well, it was a song I heard. It was a remake of a David Bowie song from probably back in the 70s. I heard this version first, and it was meaningful to me, and it just made me think about relationships that are possible and into the future under different circumstances. And so there was a little lament to me when I heard it, and it was, I think, written about the Berlin Wall that David Bowie observed back in when he was in Germany. And so there were two individuals who were lovers at the wall who lamented they couldn't have a relationship as they were on different sides of the wall.
Right.
And so, my other songs were kind of retrospective and in the moment. And this was my lamenting for what is possible in the future under possible circumstances.
Right. And that just kind of ties the knot on the conversation we just had.
Mm-hmm.
you know.
And that wasn't planned.
No. This is planned. Is I have a sign in my work in my studio that says "Plan Ahead," but the D is written at a lower yes. level because they
absolutely
didn't leave enough space for it. That's life. Yes. So let's take some time for the close of the show to look at how do you take care of yourself emotionally, intellectually, and physically. Throughout the day, weekly, monthly, yearly, and how do you know you need to do that?
Well, you start underperforming, I suppose, and that has happened, and this has been a real challenge for me.
What is underperforming? What is it that you notice in underperforming?
Your patience. So, if you are working too much at something or grinding too hard, it ends up leading to lack of patience or less creative thinking or more dissatisfaction, snippiness.
Right. So you're mulling stuff you wouldn't be mulling.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. In terms of recharge, I'm a rationalizer. And so I think that, I take a step back. There was a concept, William Osler's a famous, the father of internal medicine, and he talked about a term called imperturbability. Aquanimitas is the Latin phrase that was used. And it was the ability to kind of see horrible things, but separate yourself emotionally to kind of continue serving other patients. And so I've thought about that for years, and I think I do employ it to some extent, where I try to separate myself and keep moving forward, even though there would be some pain or difficulty in a situation.
Okay. So that's an interesting. Can I respond to that?
Sure, please.
So,
I'm looking for free advice here.
Well, the concept of non-attachment or spiritual indifference doesn't mean I'm not aware of your pain.
Right.
But your pain is your pain.
Right.
So when I was a chaplain in 1985 working with people with HIV/AIDS in Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, they're the ones dying. I'm not. I can have enormous regard for their life, but I can't. It's not mine. Mm-hmm. And it's disingenuous for me to take it on myself. So I can be present to it without owning it. So I'm not distancing myself.
Right.
And so it's a subtle use of language. I don't think you meant distance at all, but you meant not to let yourself
emotionally take it on. Well, it's to continue serving the next patient or the next human that you're
right. You and to. So you yes, and in that process you bless them mm-hmm. and you move on to the next one.
Yes.
Because the next one is the one who's with you.
Yes. And what I'm saying is you can do that with your own situation in some ways.
Oh, so that you
can actually understand that there's pain in the moment,
sure.
but that you have to put that aside to do what you need to do and that you can come back. So it's a little bit of a, I put it under the category of rationalization.
And I guess oftentimes the rationalization leads to denial, which leads to a blow up.
Could.
Which I mean, because I part that of is part the risk. Of pardon.
That's a risk, sure.
Yeah. So, but the way you describe it is as an act of knowing care that doesn't require that you do everything all of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When did you learn? How did you, as a child or as a young adult or even now, how are you learning to take care of yourself? How did you learn self-care?
Well, people around me actually helped me think about
what
that.
What did they do?
Well, they looked out for me and asked to, no one pulled me out of the fray, but they would suggest, hey, you're working pretty hard, why don't you?
How's it working for you?
How's it working for me? And again, I think people who take time off of their daily grind end up being better in their job when they come back. Mm-hmm. So I think you need time to, and I think there's some element of me going into those different worlds that I described and being refreshed relative to the world that I left.
So the complexity in and of itself is an act of self-care.
Yes, you might say that. And I don't know that I've thought about it in those terms, but.
Well, I know it. I mean, from my own experience, I know that is true. There is not a situation given the poverty and the kind of cultural difference of my upbringing that I am not the other.
Right.
So every situation I find myself in is an act of in a sense, new connection.
Well, and I'll point out, when I go and spend a solid time with family on a vacation, I sometimes quip, I need a vacation from the vacation.
Because it's too much of one thing.
it's harder than what I do at the hospital or at the base. And so it's not a question of truly relaxing. It's a question of being in a different environment. Right. So maybe it's those different social circles, worlds, roles that I hold are actually allowing the other ones to be so intensely held when I'm in them.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I was getting at. What I have learned from my own self is that I need to spend an hour reading and meditating in the morning. Most of it's with written news. But I read the news like scripture.
Yes.
Which means you read it critically, analytically, and you just hold it there. I wonder what will come of this.
I do the same thing. I'm aware of what's going on in the world. I do read the news. I listen to the news, different sources.
Uh-huh.
So I will admit I listen to MSNBC and Fox by going in between them, and I find that very interesting.
Yes,
and
yes.
It's some people have, sometimes I'll bring up, hey, what do you think of this? And that's one of those things where some people are very upset about the news right now and don't even want to talk about
it.
So,
right.
But I like talking about things like that.
Yeah. And so I'm interrupting with my stuff, but let me,
no, please.
People who have become so issue oriented, so institution oriented, when their ideas or their side is losing or is challenged or is whatever, it becomes almost impossible for them to hold on. This is the way in which modernity and its strong emphasis on issues and institutions and science and data and fact make us weaker persons. Because if we were stronger persons, we would hold on to these opposites without being undone, without becoming reactive or volatile.
That's interesting.
And so we need stronger persons at the time when our society is so less able to help us form them.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But how do you take? So you've spoken about what I would say the moving allows you to get some emotional balance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in terms of the way you have described it.
Yes.
How do you take care of yourself physically?
Well, I go to the gym and I get into shape. So one of the good things that the military is that there's an annual physical fitness test, and I need to run a couple of miles and do so many push-ups, age adjusted, of course, and sit-ups and all this other stuff. And these days they actually measure your body composition, your waist, so you can't even fake it. You know, it used to be that you'd finish the mile and a half run and it wouldn't be pretty, but you could get through it. Now they actually measure a waist circumference, which is linked to metabolic syndrome and diabetes.
Sure, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
So that's a good example of where I don't know if I wasn't a military member, if I would have recovered. That was kind of their rules helping me comply with a healthier lifestyle. So right about now, my colleagues at the hospital know that this is the time of the year that Marty starts making sure he's serious about being in shape for the summer physical fitness test.
Right, right. But what you're saying is that you have to find the internal motivation, the voluntary labor, by which to take care of yourself.
Yes.
Yeah. And so
you can't do everything. There's always going to be, I call it smart failure, that you have to... And at different times you can fail in different ways, and fail is maybe too hard a word, but you you dedicate more time on certain things that are more timely, and then you don't forget about the other issues, but you come back to them.
Right. And what I like about you using the term smart failure is that you don't minimize the loss.
Right.
Too many people who want to stay on the optimistic, positive side do not call a failure a failure.
Mm-hmm.
Just let it be.
Yeah.
It's not going to be the end of your life.
Right.
In most instances. And if it is, then we can celebrate that.
Yes. It is an offensive term to some, and I've used failure and offended people.
I know. But there are some offenses that are worth making.
True.
And that actually allows us each to hold our space if we can respect it.
I'm with you.
Good. So how do you take care of yourself intellectually?
I think I read a lot. I actually I exchange ideas with people, and then I usually internalize those ideas and think about them and explore them. And we live in a rich community where there's a lot of ideas floating around. So I usually find myself, not that I plan this, but hearing about topics that I didn't expect. So recently there was a grand rounds at the hospital about environmental sustainability, and it really got me thinking. It was a mind-opening, and the suggestion was that physicians think about their a patient's commitment to environmentally safe practices. Now, sure. This is nothing I learned in medical school. It's nothing I've incorporated in my practice until now, but that is a challenging idea.
And much of our routines and protocols in the hospital have to do with the use of a lot of resources.
Yes. The carbon footprint of a hospitalization is
huge.
High.
Yeah.
So it's just, I think you end up fine. If you're open to new ideas, I find myself encountering them all the time. Mm-hmm. And the chairman of medicine at Penn, when I was doing my residency on the first day, he challenged us to remain open to learning new things as you go along instead of closing your mind and being entirely task-oriented. And right. I did take that personally. And so when I come across ideas or new words,
right.
I look them up and I read about the ideas or the words or the concepts or the alternate viewpoints,
right.
and I try to stay up.
Right. And what you've just described, though, isn't just the learning of new techniques
mm-hmm.
to do similar, same old things.
Right.
It's learning a new way to appreciate a problem or to have a new problem or a new structure.
Yes.
And that's a different order of learning. And
yes.
we often don't think about that as we age.
Yes.
So,
well, one of the most meaningful experiences in my life was a year-long assignment that I took with the, and I'm an Air Force officer, but I took with the Navy, studying cyber operations back in 2008. And it was a think tank situation. And it was a really risky move for a young physician to go outside of medicine and do an assignment on cyber operations. And I did some night physician work during that time to stay competent with
sure.
my medical skills. But talk about a totally different environment. And none of my education to that point dealt with computer science or cyber. And that was, you know, 10 plus years ago when that was just emerging as a situation. Now we know what countries do to influence other countries and
sure.
cyber wars and cyber operations.
Yep.
But that was a very new concept that people didn't even think about back then.
And you were already just 5 years out of med school.
Yes. And so there was, you know, one of my advisements to young people in their career is to take risks early in your career and go outside of your comfort zones into new areas and try to draw bridges between more traditional fields.
Neat. Neat. Marty, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Thank you. You as well.
Yes. We're going to close with Hero of the Day.
Metallica and the San Francisco Symphonic Orchestra. And a couple of things about this. You know, one is a very eclectic combination of Metallica with a symphony orchestra. And the other idea is this was the idea of a temporary hero, not being necessarily permanently valued by those who were seeking it. So I found this an interesting song when I first heard it about, I don't
Hero
know, 8 years
the
ago.
Day.
There you go. Thank you.
Down.